This is Gene Ruff, 7th of December, 1992. The story of Birgitta House, Psyche in Community.
In our fall series, The Seasons of Life, this is the story of the Birgitta House, Psyche in Community. Gene Ruff will be speaking on how this six-year program of the Birgitta House began from a trusting relationship with an eight-year-old boy. Today is a nonprofit public benefit with seven volunteer therapists and interns working individually with about 40 children a week. And these children come of their own volition to this house. That's it.
I'm on the program committee, which is why I'm introducing the speaker. I don't know Jean, and I'm very much looking forward to her presentation and to finding out about Birgitta House. What I know a little about it, just from things I read in the newsletter, and it's a therapy center for children. And Jean is a certified psychotherapist who lives and resides in Port Townsend, and she has a Jungian orientation. And I'd like you all to welcome Jean Ruff.
Thank you, Gordon. And I want to thank the Jungian Society for inviting me to speak tonight. When Lucretia Devine asked if I would share the story of Birgitta House as a part of these series on the seasons of life, she was seeing Birgitta House as an expression of the psyche that came through my own sort of midlife crisis. So I want to begin by telling the ending first, and that's a little bit about what Birgitta House has become. It's a nonprofit public benefit organization in Port Townsend, and it was created for the purpose of nurturing a child's self-expression or expression of self with some therapeutic support. A uniqueness of Birgitta House is that we do not charge fees for the work that we do with the children. We reside in a quaint Victorian house, and when a child comes, it has a choice of maybe shooting baskets outside or playing in the garden, working in the art materials, the clay or the paints, or possibly creating some images in the sand tray room. The staff of professional therapists and interns are all volunteers, and no one on the staff is paid. We serve about 30 to 40 children a week. So this is what Birgitta House, in a short synopsis, is what it has become. And I had intended to share some slides tonight of the children's drawings and of the sand trays. However, recently I've been questioning the choice to expose their work in this way. And I want to apologize for anybody that might have read in the brochure that you would be seeing slides tonight if you are extremely disappointed about that. But prior to each of my last two talks, I had dreams before each of the last two talks. One was that the projector broke down, and I was intending to show slides, and I went ahead and did. And the next talk that I gave the night before, I had a dream where everybody fell asleep when I showed slides. And again, it was the night before, and there I was in Seattle, and it was out of a fear of, well, if I don't show these slides, how am I going to fill this time of not being able to sort of let go and to pay attention. So it seemed too late to try to change what I had already intended. About 2 days ago, John Radecki gave a workshop for the staff at Birgitta House, and afterwards we discussed this issue of showing children's works. And we shared that if it is a moral issue, then who or what makes the decision to show the slides? We can't expect the child to give us permission. It's a very different issue than when you're working with an adult. And when I was asked to provide a drawing or a picture for the Jungian newsletter, I thought, the one that I happened to pick out, I thought, gee, this is a good one. But I did not consider a sense of an inner knowing about whether that was a good choice to do that or not. But as I stayed with this moral issue, I realized that before I considered the sharing of a child's dreams or images, that I needed to be willing to reveal my own. So in October, when I had begun my homework for this talk, and I was reading a book that I enjoyed very much called Money and the Meaning of Life by Jacob Needleman, and seeing how that whole issue of money, and he speaks about how we don't treat the value of money highly enough, seeing how it related to the whole issue of Birgitta House and not charging fees. So I began taking notes and marking the pages for the quotes that I might share. And then I had this dream. Suddenly I'm told that I'm to present shortly. I do not have my notes and quotes with me. So I consider going home real quickly. But the people are preparing to eat, and it feels it would be too disruptive for me to hurry home and come back. So I stay. And I ponder about what I've been thinking I would say, and I just stay with those thoughts. And then it is time, and I'm introduced. And suddenly this is happening in Potsdam, and the audience appears to be faculty. Potsdam is the small town I grew up in. It's in way up in northern New York State, south of the Canadian border. And my father was a college professor, so I grew up very much a part of a university setting. So in giving this talk, you are now all the faculty at Potsdam State. I mention how we at Brigida House include blacks, and that this makes our program unusual. And a man, an older faculty member, stands up and says that at Potsdam State, they had the first black years ago, and his name was Sherman. And I think to myself, well, that may be true. And I let him speak, but I know that he's not hearing what I'm saying. He's not differentiating. I was not referring to black as a particular person. I was referring to the quality of blackness. Now, this is an important dream. And what is it saying about Brigida House? There is this sense of blackness in our culture that's placed on a person or an entity so it can be carried, such in the dream it was placed on Sherman. And blackness becomes an object, then we can sever off relationship. It becomes something that can be eliminated. We can pass laws to protect ourselves, to heal it. But this can't be done with the quality of blackness. The quality of blackness speaks to us about humanity. Relationship is inherent with blackness, but not necessarily. We don't necessarily need to relate to the blacks we may know. Brigida House preserves the quality of blackness, while the institution, as symbolized by the university setting in the dream, objectifies blackness into a black. In this case, his name was Sherman. I did not know a black Sherman in Potsdam, and I'm still struggling with where the name Sherman came from. But what is this dream saying about the presentation? I'd already relinquished the idea of showing slides, and now it's saying no notes and no quotes. So what's left? And what I felt was left was the story, which is the quality and the essence of Brigida House, and to go back to its source. So I turned to my journals, and I began putting together the dreams and events that led to Brigida House. And I spent a lot of time on the computer typing this and gathering the information together. And as I climbed into bed last night, I happened to mention to my husband, Jim, who is with us tonight, that I was going to be reading what I had gathered together from my notes and my journals. And I did. And Jim freaked out. What do you mean you're going to read your notes? You just need to just sit and talk and tell the story. So I went to sleep with that feeling, knowing that there was some difference in this case. And before, I have just told the story. But this time I felt there was a difference about the story and that it needed to really relate to the dreams. And I didn't know if I could trust myself remembering exactly how Psyche might have spoken. And I think it's important that we say it correctly. So anyway, yes, I did have a dream. So I quickly added this to my talk this morning. That it's time for me to present to you, and it's a piano concert. Oh no, I'm not prepared. I haven't been practicing the piano. I'm not experienced enough. I don't know enough pieces by memory for a concert. How can I possibly do this? Then I realized that I can. I do know how to play the piano, and that I play fairly well. And if the audience would accept the humbleness of my reading the notes, then I could present a concert. This feels okay. And I even add some handwritten notes to the already printed music. And when I woke up, I realized that, there is this distinction about that if the talk were to just improvise and tell the story, which I could do, then I could just play without the written notes. But if the task is to actually relate to the unfolding of the psyche, then I'm not quite prepared to do that. So if you will stay with me, there's going to be some reading. And there'll be little commentary. I feel that the dreams just present themselves as they are, and I don't want to take I don't feel it's necessary to really go into the analysis of the dreams. They'll stand by themselves. And the whole issue of money will be woven in and out throughout. And then after the break, we'll talk some more about the issue of money, and we'll look more about what the phenomenon of Brigitte House is today. So there'll be no slides and no notes or quotes, that is to say, from other people's writings. And also, I want you to keep in mind that it's not the whole story. It's a point in time. I'm going to be revealing my own psychic journey in the development of Brigitte House, but that you're just seeing a little piece of it, and you're not seeing all that went through before it, and you're not seeing all that's happened afterwards. So mostly it's going to be from the time period of about 1985 to 1987. Welcome, Randy. I already mentioned that I'll tell you a little bit about my background. I already mentioned that I was born in Potsdam, or spent most of my childhood in Potsdam, New York. I went to college at St. Lawrence University, and I majored in mathematics and minored in physics. This is a long way from Jungian work, right? I worked at Xerox Corporation for about 10 years, helped Xerox plan its financial future as a strategy planner, and I was paid very well, particularly as a woman. Met my husband, Jim. We shared an office together. We had a little crisis, a big crisis, in the family, and Jim's side of the family that brought us immediately to Bellevue, Washington. A son was born, and I was thriving in my crisis of plenty that I call. I had a wonderful husband, a wonderful son. I had security, happiness, and money. Somewhere along the way, I attended a little seminar, and the leader suggested that we might listen to our dreams that night. The thought of listening to a dream was extremely foreign to me at that point in time. And lo and behold, I had a dream, and I wrote it down. And it was this instant wholeheartedness of just being initiated into the mystery of dreams. I didn't understand the dream. The dream didn't mean anything to me, that very first dream. It still, every time I go back and look at it, I still don't quite understand what that first dream meant. Though shortly afterwards, I did have a dream about the third night that my house that I grew up in was on fire. And I'm trying to get out of the house, and nobody in my family, I go to my mother, my father, everybody in the family, and no one can hear me, which is an indication of what was to come. I was at that time 32 years old. Not being able to have a second child was a very, very painful time for me. And I finally turned to further studies of graduate school. And I considered the sort of a traditional approach and considered going into education, but I realized that my real interest is in my dreams, and I discovered International College, which is now no longer exists. It's part of William Lyons, but at the time it was a university without walls where you could define the mentor you wanted to work with and you could define the curriculum that you wanted to deal with. And so that was how I met Dr. Russell Lockhart. He became my mentor and my analyst. And I developed a thesis on the psyche's weaving on the image of house. This is our first little clue. We've got Brigitte House, and here's my first little weaving on the image of house. And as I was completing my master's thesis, it occurred to me, at the time Russell Lockhart was living in Port Townsend, and my family was living down in California, so I was making trips back and forth to work on the thesis. And as my thesis was coming to a close, I realized that I was saying goodbye to Port Townsend. But I suddenly realized that Port Townsend was actually a town one could choose to live in. And I didn't have to say goodbye. So I came home and I suggested to Jim that he just quit his job. That's not all. Not only would he quit his job, but he would not work. And we would move to Port Townsend and we would just take a year off, the three of us. I felt like Jim had given me the opportunity to spend this time really focused on my dreams and my own work as I was working on the master's program, and I wanted Jim to have that opportunity, which is difficult when you're a man and you're trying to support the family. So we sold our house and we moved to Port Townsend, and we enjoyed the year and sort of waited to see what the year might bring. A part of my waiting was I had my degree now, so now I'm an adult psychotherapist, right? And being very introverted, I just sort of sat by the phone. And I didn't get any calls. And I have this dream. I have two sons. One is kidnapped and the body is taken away, and suddenly the body disappears. I scream in despair, throwing myself into the street. He's gone. This is what the journey is all about. It is the search for the missing son. This is why the urgency, the passion, the intensity, the yearning, the never-stopping search. And a few days later, I had a very high fever. The highest fever that I can recall having was somewhat delirious, and I had the dream. Time and space had no boundaries. I entered a labyrinth of intricately woven circles of repeated patterns, and I could not stop or get out. To get to my work, I must climb a ladder that goes straight up. It's very scary, but I do it. I work on the 14th floor, but there really is no 14th floor, so the elevator can't be taken. There is another way to get to my work, and that is to take the stairs that go under the ground. I continued with the pain of wanting to have a second child. And then I met Eli. Eli was a delightful 10-year-old boy, very high-spirited, who had come to our house to play with my son, both of whom were 10 at the time. And my son is very athletic, and so the activity was to throw a ball or something out in the street, and Eli was not very athletic, and he finally came in the house, and he discovered me in the backyard in my studio with paints and clay and all kinds of goodies. And he asked if he could stay and paint with me, and so he did. And when he left that day, I realized that I had just simply provided a laboratory for him. He didn't need any of my help, just a lab and love. And I wondered if this would be the same thing in working with adults. And then I thought, I need to do something about getting my office set up. I had a dream of being in Mexico in this wonderful resort, having a great time in the sun. And suddenly I see this isn't for me. That if I'm going to go to Mexico, I need to go to the artifacts and the ruins. The image of Mexico will come up again later on. But I saw this dream as sort of a final little thread, one of the final lasting threads of splitting with the collective. And that in actuality, I was being very fulfilled with my relationship with Eli, but that I couldn't see it as to what it was happening. There's this part of me that was switching and saying, all right, now someday I'm going to be a therapist, and someday I'm going to have my two office chairs. Eli came again, and he was working in the wood, and he said, the wood moves like a ship back and forth. It's like a snake shedding its skin. And he asked me, where does your imagination come from? And when he first saw our computer, he said, can it read my mind? Can it read what is in my imagination? Can it print it? The dream. Somebody died in the history department, so now Eli is moving his desk and will have an office to himself. Eli, I wondered, could this be the injured child who's discovering his imagination as I am discovering my own? More and more art is flowing through Eli's paintings and his clay work. And his parents have decided, since he's doing all this art, that he should go to an art teacher for lessons. And I am horrified. He doesn't need lessons. He just needs a way for his unconscious to flow. And what I can offer Eli is that experience, not the lessons. He brought me one of his art class paintings, and they were these little separate kind of creatures from the sea, but each creature was very distinct in different colors on the page. And it was almost like he was filling in the lines, and I thought, this isn't the way he usually paints. Eli began playing our piano, and the sounds just poured forth, and I thought how different it would be if I were to interrupt this process and give him lessons. In the dream, working from this other direction as with Eli on the piano, there's all these little hints that the psyche's starting to present that I'm not seeing yet. What becomes poisonous as a child now becomes fruitful as a delicacy. I considered a job. I mean, I wasn't earning any money being an adult therapist, right? The phone hadn't rung yet, so I thought I should get a job. So I applied at Centrum for, I think it was Olympics of the Mind, and went through an interview process. And as I drove home, I thought, no, this is not the way I want to be with children. But I want to be with children the way that I am with Eli. Eli came, and he was trying to tell me a dream that he'd had the night before, and there was a lot of banging going on in the house, was under construction. And he said he was having difficulty being able to remember the dream. And then he said, TV can make the dream disappear. And so can one look at cotton candy. In the dream, sometimes you need to aim the gun at the deer, not to shoot the deer, But putting your thumb on the trigger triggers your body to be connected to what is happening and what you are experiencing. You act with whatever, not for that in itself. You act to see what happens next. It isn't that you stay on the first thread. There is always the shifting, and this connects to the deer. And a few nights later, a vision of seeing the deer now lying down. We are now together. We're now communicating. The phone rang. It was a parent asking me if I would work with their 4-year-old boy. I thought, I don't work with children. But then I wasn't working with adults yet either. So I went to bed that night to think about it, and when I woke up in the morning, I had this image of asking the parents to have the boy take a brown paper sack and put into it what he wanted to bring to me. So the parents did. And the reason the parents were interested in having this boy, Ken, come to work with me was because that he showed signs of more interest in girl-type activities like Barbie dolls and whatever. I use the name Ken. It's not his real name, but I had made the connection to Barbie dolls. At least not consciously. So what Ken wanted to put in the sack was a blue truck and a unicorn, and he was very insistent on these two things. And they came as a shock to his parents because they assumed that he'd want to put the Barbie dolls in the sack. And in fact, the blue truck was something they had to look under the bed and try to find. So he came, and things seemed to work well in being with Ken. But still, I'm wondering, how am I going to earn any money? Thought about maybe getting a job at the local bank. I've always sort of had this interest of being a teller. It's probably my major in mathematics back in college. The dream. Some people earn more money only to spend more money. I gave up on the bank job. Eli was going to move out of town, so he came for his last time with me. He made my right thumb in clay, and he asked me to sign my name on the bottom. He wanted to take this with him. He had written a book, a wonderful book, and he had pictures in it, and he was saddened. He wanted me to make a copy of his book so we could each have a copy of it. So I took him to a copy machine, and he'd never seen one before. And he was saddened by the fact that the machine didn't correct his mistakes. He was also saddened by the fact that it didn't print in color, so he went back and redid so both of our copies would have colored pages in it. The dream. I'm servicing cars, and I realize that I have something to bring, a way to serve. It's not my knowledge of cars. It's more in response to the emotional and psychological needs of the customer. It looks as if I will keep this job, and I might even get paid. I'm needing to create a different space for Ken, other than my two chairs. So Russell Lockhart suggested that I might consider a sand tray. He also gave me a book by Dora Kalf, and the first thing I noticed in the book was that she talked about the mechanic that's in the child, and I remembered my dream about servicing the cars and serving some way as a mechanic. I built a sand tray. I wasn't aware of, I'd never seen a sand tray room. I knew nothing about a sand tray. And I just went down in the basement and built one. And put sand in it and went through the house and found as many small little things I could find, Q-tips, whatever, to put into the sand tray. This is the dream. I'm working with a boy, a young boy, in art. And his art becomes a key that can open the door near us, that enters into a passageway that leads to an innermost sanctuary of the church. I think it's really important here, the word us. It's not that the work is just the boy is able to do this, but there's an usness about the fact that his doing the art and my being present with that is including both of us. It is the room behind the pulpit that is secret for the priest. The boy and I enter, and a woman enters, and I tell her about the key. She is the keeper of the words. We speak to each other, and then she follows me out the passageway to meet the boy and to see his art. Another dream. Why do children keep coming to us? It is clear now that Jim and I have come to Port Townsend to help the children. But where am I? No job. A little bit of money. I have one child now, right? And I'm continuing with the pain of not being able to conceive. And I had this dream that I wanted to share. In the dream, there was a phone number. and the phone number was 385-4715. I looked in our reverse directory. There was a 4714 and a 4716, and there was no 4715. But I decided to dial the number anyway. And to my dismay, somebody answered the phone. I was hoping by the reverse directory I could figure out ahead of time, right, who was going to answer the phone. A woman answered. I said, "Well, you're not going to believe this, but I had a dream last night of your phone number. And I just need to know who you are, and you're not in the reverse directory." She said, "Let's have lunch." So we did. It turns out she was a poet, and she had a young son. And we spent most of the time at lunch sharing her stories about her son, and that he was more interested in his stories and imagination than he was in schoolwork. And later, as Brigida House grew, he ended up coming to Brigida House. A dream. A dream of the image of two three-dimensional animal creatures facing each other. The one on the right symbolizes the conscious and contains a center, like a ball, a sphere. The one on the left symbolizes the unconscious. The sphere, or self, had been with the unconscious and is now moved and is carried by the right, or consciousness. And between the two lay a lit candle, a green one. Three other candles were lit around, forming an outer trinity. Each unicorn creature was on top of its own hill, and the hills were connected by smaller hills and valleys. They directly faced one another. This dream speaks of the duality of the unicorn. I remembered Ken bringing his unicorn, and by this time, the unicorn, and he had, I happened to have two unicorns in the sand tray, a blue one and a brown one, and the two of them had become very critical to his work. This is one of the issues that I have with sand tray, is what if I had had three, but I only had two. But there is something about this duality of unicorns that that I'm very interested in. I took the images and I formed them in clay and put them in the sand tray and lit the candle. And I brought a picture of this. It's been a very important image for me. And there's a table set outside at break. You can take a look and see it. And it became, it was hot, close to Christmas time, so I took the images, the two unicorns, which in the picture, they don't going to look like your normal, usual unicorn. But to me, the sense was unicorns, and I drew them on our holiday cards and sent them out. More concerns about money and finances. Why don't I get a job? Dream about volunteering in my son's math class, and then the teacher recommends me as a therapist. Well, maybe that will work. Eli returned after a few months. He did an incredible sand tray, and I had a vision of working with children in all kinds of ways that filled me. I mean, after all, Eli didn't have a particular problem. And it wasn't his parents that brought him to me. Why not work with any child who is so inclined? Do I need to work only with problem children? Isn't it the issue to open the unconscious and to take it seriously? I felt an excitement about this possibility. But I still wasn't ready to see that that actually was my work. I still was sort of staying with this idea in my mind that I was a therapist and would have paying clients. The dream, right? The next visit, Eli didn't come. His stepfather chose to punish him, and the punishment was that he could not come and see me. He called to tell me, and he was crying. So the next day, I went and I met with his father. It was my first attempt at trying to communicate with a parent what the child and I had been experiencing. And the next time Eli came, he was crying again. And I asked him what was wrong, and he said that the teachers had given him assignment at school to write a short story. And I said, "Well, so what's the problem here?" And he said, "Well, the teacher said it needs to be about 150 words. And when I write a story, I don't know how long it's going to be." And he was really feeling that pain. The dream. I'm working with a girl as a counselor. The girl that I counsel has no money, and she begins to tell me the story of how her father somewhat abandoned her and that she's now on her own. And I feel that my counseling goes farther with her when I leave the role as counselor and be a friend. There is more relationship that way. By now I'm working with more than just Ken. I have a few children I'm working with, and I actually go out and print some business cards and put on it that I'm a child therapist. But I still see the work with Eli as being something separate. One of the parents of the children I'm working with calls me and laments, "My child doesn't have a problem anymore," implying that I somehow fixed it, right? "But he still wants to come and see you. I don't know what to do because I don't want to pay you when he doesn't have a problem, and yet he's insistent that he come again." I tell her that I'm a child therapist, and I told her what my hourly rate was, and after all, that's what I am, right? In the dream, let the child be the focus. All radiates through the child. And another image. There is a one-to-one relationship between the movement of the objects in the sand tray and real life. It's similar to how an object in the computer can be made larger or smaller by the movement of the mouse. You have to have a Macintosh to get that part. And I woke with a sense of this understanding that can come through that sense of archetypal knowing. But there's also an understanding that can come from just being with the experience in the moment with the child and being with the movements that he makes in the sand tray. And that I can write about my experience of being with the child and the flow of the sand tray work, but I cannot write about the child's experience. And that there is a danger when the importance of the experience comes through the mythic and archetypal associations that's not associated with the directness of the experience. Writings on sand tray that treat the creation of the tray as stagnant concern me. Work in the tray is a flow that's always moving. The dream. Jim and I are going to get married. We were married once before. There are a few hours before the wedding, so I'm waiting. And while I wait, a man friend gives me a wedding gift. A sculpture he has made. He's made only a few sculptures. This one is still not yet dry. What he's giving me is seen by all, but he and the giving seem to be just between the two of us. I'm deeply struck by the synchronicity of this happening because 2 days ago I'd had a dream, this is still now within the dream, where I was given the exact same figure and was told then that it was God. Now here I am, having been given and having received God on my wedding day. I'm holding God in my hands, and this time it is not a dream. Though it is. I tell him that I need a box, a container, to hold the statue because it is so fragile, not having dried. He rearranges the figure and places it in a safe container and hands it back to me. I know that the God figure is very much like the winged unicorn holding the ball from the other dream. And then there was another little image about Yosemite, a chance of being there, but it's very crowded during the summer, Christmas, and at high tide. Isn't that great? I love how dreams work that way. Well, this was what you'd call a big dream. And when I woke up, I was faced with getting breakfast ready and my husband and his activities and my son and his activities. And it didn't seem to fit with the dream. And I felt I needed to leave. So I left the house and I drove to Marrowstone Island. I ended up at the Sound View Cemetery. And I noticed a gravestone of a man who had lived 100 years. And I noticed another gravestone of a little girl who had lived a day, or maybe less. I tried to stay with the image of the dream. Other images and thoughts kept coming, and I kept going back to the image of the statue, and what did it mean to have received God in the statue? And then it came to me. At first it was like a snail that I could just crush unknowingly. But slowly it grew until I was faced with a savage bull. I felt there was nowhere to turn and that I must face it. And this was it. The three of us, my husband, my son, and myself, need to buy a small camper and drive to Mexico for a month. Could we fly? No. I'd really rather go to Scotland. No. What about my work? What about Jim's work? It can wait a month. Where will the money come from? You need to go. Just go. This journey speaks of the remarriage. Take your knitting. Going to Mexico is following the need to be immersed in the unknown, the unfamiliar, the dust, the dirt, the dryness. It also has to do with color and yarn and primitive figures and baskets and basketball. It was a financial struggle for us to choose to do this. And when I came home and told Jim that I'd had this, I'd have to say that it was like a visionary kind of experience. It was a kind of experience where you're shaking in your boots. It's hard to imagine that being told you need to go to Mexico for a month and take a month off would have that kind of feeling. But it did. It was very big. And what did it mean for us to go in a situation where we didn't have any money? And I just started working with adults. I finally had some adult clients come. But we did. We bought an RV. It was a Sundancer. And I'd had a dream about that. We came over to Seattle to go to a Jungian lecture, and on the way home going north on I-5, the engine blew. Another financial drain. Is this really meant to be? How are we ever going to get to Mexico when we can't even drive to Seattle? And then I had this dream. I'm finding the dear Brigida that I had befriended, and I'm bringing it home in the RV. And the deer speaks to me of my involvement with children. The next day we went to Hurricane Ridge over near Port Angeles. And there were lots of opportunities to see deer. In this one case, there were a few deer in the side of the road. And we had our dog with us, Lion. Her name is Lion, in the back seat of the car. And the deer was approaching the car, so we decided to roll the window down. And our dog, Lion, was just absolutely trembling. I mean, just shaking. And the deer came right up to the window, with the windows rolled down, came right up and licked the dog on his nose. And I wondered, is this Brigida? I was asked to give my first talk about the work that I was doing with children. And I had this dream the night before him to give the talk. I start my talk with the image of the butterfly because that is what I look for, patterns. And that is what each child is moving to be, unique in color and pattern. The night before we left for our Mexico trip in the RV, the dream was I apply at the University of Rochester for their program in pastoral psychology, and they reject me. From the work that I gave them, they say that I am not an artist. Art is the medium through which the psyche manifests itself, and this is what is coming for me. There's this differentiation between art that comes as a manifestation of the psyche and art in this other sense of applying for pastoral psychology. Our last stop out of town was a stop at Dr. Lockhart's house, and he handed me his manuscript for Psyche Speaks, which had not yet been printed into a book. When I look back now, I think Jim and Dan and I all realized that the 30 days that we spent in that RV and going into the dryness and the darkness of Mexico were an incredible experience for us all. And of course, it came with many, many dreams. But the two that stand out for me, one was that Hermes is dead and Eros lives. And the other dream is body and spirit are now one. And as I return to my work with the children, I was working with a little boy named Morgan. And in the dream, he turns on the radio. And when I ask him about it, he's obviously checking me just to see whether I'm going to bawl him out or whatever about turning on the radio. But then I ask him what happened when he did it. And this move to take his action seriously, no matter what it might be, is the key to my work with children. I'm going to take a little sidestep here because I was working also with a group of children that somehow ended up coming to our house. And they wanted to put on a skit show, and so we did a little thing they ended up calling Monday Night Live, where they danced and they made up little skits and they showed it to their parents. And it all happened within my home. And when I was doing that with the children, I had a dream about a tabloid. And the thought of possibly working with children in developing a children's newspaper. And I didn't have any idea what this was all about, and I had no interest in working on a newspaper. But I paid attention to it, and so I went to this group of kids that were working on the skit show, and I asked them how they might feel about putting together a newspaper, and they were very positive about it. They thought it was a great idea. What has evolved from that is we're now in our sixth year of producing a children's newspaper through Brigida House. that's called What? The children came up with that name. It's WH?AT. And I'll share more about that later. But that was the first dream that came into that. I was working on the computer, and I'd actually gone beyond lunch, which is very unlike me. And I stopped and decided to go outside. It was a beautiful day, and our cherry tree was still having a few cherries in it. And I sat looking at the cherry tree, and I suddenly see that I don't want to work with children as I'm now doing, that I want Eli back. I want the relationship that we had that was absent of money issues, that was absent of parents' control of whether the child comes or not. I want to just be with the child in his creative psychic flow. And that was the beginning of Brigida House. And as I sat there, I realized that I was going to continue working with children, but at that point in time, I no longer was going to charge fees. And I was just going to see what happened out of that experience. That the charging fee somehow was creating a vacuum in terms of the way that I could really freely be with the child. I also didn't want it to be called going to Jean's house. I wanted it to have another name, and I didn't know what the name might be. I considered the Center for Creative Choice. It's real creative, right? I sort of like the three C's. I was at Russell Lockhart's, and I was talking to him about this possibility of this possibly being the name for the Center for Creative Choice. And as we're having this conversation, he has this beautiful window that overlooks Mount Baker, and this deer came and approached the window. And we both stopped and looked at this deer, and in that moment I knew that this new entity that was coming to birth here was going to be called Brigida, and it soon became Brigida House. 3 nights in a row I had images of don't worry about the money, just go ahead and do it. What does this mean? I just finally made this decision. I just printed up my business cards. I'm a child therapist. This is how I earn my living. What does it mean to not charge money? What does it mean to not worry about money? I looked up to see if I could find any information about Brigida, because it was very clear in the dream, the spelling of it. And I have not yet found anything that is spelled just exactly that way. But there is a goddess, Bridget or Brigida, who had 8 children. And she was a goddess of the aspects of healing. And she was the patron saint of hearth, home, and sacred wells. And her celebration day is October 8th. Remember that date. It's going to come up again. And Gita also is the mother of dancing and Buddhism. And she also was one of 8 mothers. So there's that 8 coming up again. And B-E-R is a gypsy word for breast. So all 3 of those connections, though none of them quite fit the name Brigida, all seem to have a very strong feminine tone to them. Dream of Brigida House over and over and over, and finding a store that sells conch shells and buying them for Brigida House, working with the children upstairs in what had become this sort of office space. And I see that the psyche had given birth, and I was suddenly presented with the need to cut the umbilical cord and to name and to nurture what this was. And as a concept, Brigida House was being with a child in whatever way that he or she may need. And by not charging fees, the children had the freedom of choice to enter into therapeutics. Of course, in their minds, they're coming to Brigida House, which serves to minimize the stigma that can often reside with going to see a therapist. Children in their and my uniqueness, where truly anything can be experienced and explored. And the next time that Eli came, I felt it was so freeing. That it's more important for a child to have a way to be in relationship with his or her true self than it is for the child to have an opportunity to share and tell his or her feelings and emotions to someone. If a child has a way to experience the self, then he or she can survive whatever trauma, even without someone to express their feelings and emotions. And I had a dream that Carol Barrington died. She committed suicide. And guess what? She willed all her money to Brigida House. This was our first donation. Except it's a dream, right? I looked at Carol. Who's Carol? Carol was a studious student. She and I were both very into being good A-plus students in high school. And her father happened to be the president of the university at Potsdam State. So there was something about her dying that spoke to me about my own need to have this death of that part that was a studious student in trying to be a therapist. And I had a dream of the paradox of seeing and responding to the I've had enough that lets go of being a therapist, and that by the letting go, only then can one truly be a therapist. And that was a dream. The first issue of the paper was getting ready to come out, and the dreams are seeing the blocks and the columns of the paper as if they're three-dimensional, if they have sort of an aliveness to their own. I registered Brigida House as a business, finally, in Port Townsend. And when I came home that day, on the front porch were boxes and several boxes of Brigida House stationery that had been a gift from an old friend that had received my unicorn Christmas card. We sold our first issue of the What newspaper, and we sold out. The children had gone down and gotten advertising to help pay for it. And then I had this dream. There are three levels. The first level is finding an individual way to move towards the individual path of beingness. It is the initial step of being on the journey where individual patterns are broken and individual ways. It's a lot of individual there. The second stage is where collective ways are experienced towards the individual path of beingness. This stage is the basis of Jungian psychology, where the shadow, the anima, animus, etc., are faced, discerned, experienced, and known. It is collective because it can be described in very similar ways for most individuals. The third stage is the differentiation of a highly individualized way to experience the unique beingness of the self. This is what I am experiencing in my struggle to move the power of the animus and eros from what I feel activated through Steve to within myself. Only then is the power truly mine. Only then can eros serve through me. And Steve was a friend whom I was very attracted to, particularly his poetic way with words, and he'd been connected also to the RV that we had. This work will take 23 to 24 weeks. This is the work I am to bring and share with Russ. And when this work is fulfilled, then I will experience life as a highly spiritual being. And then this will be the fourth stage. It is from this stage that Jung was able to write and to know of the earlier stages. And though very few of his writings actually reflect his direct experience of this stage, a book of his poetry may someday be revealed. I have since learned that others have had dreams about a book of Jung's poetry. So Brigida House was born. We formed a Friends of Brigida House as a way to try to get some financing. I wrote to the IRS and asked for 501c3 nonprofit status. And there was a series of many, many synchronistic events. It soon grew too big for our home, and the house next door was available to rent. So I went and asked them if I could use the house for Brigida House. And of course she said no, she didn't want all these kids in the house. And so she rented the house, and a few months later it was available again. I went knocking on the door, and the third time she finally said okay. But the house was for sale, and I was really afraid we were going to lose the house. And somewhere in this time, Edith Sewell came to visit. And she was with me in my own home, and we were looking next door at this house at 1018 Taylor. And I was telling her about the dream about having that house for Brigida House. And she said, you'll find a way. You must find a way. And shortly thereafter, a woman came into my life by the name of Barbara Bowen. She lived down in California. She was visiting Port Townsend, and she wanted to meet me. I showed her Brigida House, how we were using this house. And that night, she came back and rang the doorbell about 8 o'clock at night. And I said, well, hi, Barbara. And she said, hi. She said, I know this sounds crazy, but I want to buy that house, 1018 Taylor, for Brigida House. And so she did. We pay a rent. She actually owns the house, and we make some rent payments. But for the last 3 years, we've been in that house. But in the process of buying the house, we did this all by owner, and I sort of served as the go-between realtor. there was a lien on the property from the previous owner, and so I want to tell this little story as an example of some of the synchronicity that's happened around Brigida House. So I went to the, the escrow office, whatever, and asked them if they could check to see if there really had been a lien on this property. And sure enough, there was. And the lien on the property through the IRS, there's a time period of 6 years and 1 month and a day. And that had expired on October 6, 1988. And we had signed the escrow agreement on October 7th. And on October 8th, which you remember was the celebration day for St. Brigida, the escrow agreement had been accepted. So we bought the house. A dream. A man questions me about my work with the children. He says it is great that I work in literature with the children, referring to the what newspaper? And that must be my training. Oh no, I say. I was a math major and I detested literature. That's true. It's not literature that I do with children. There is no mention of writing or reading or English. We just do together. The man is astounded and he replies, "Then you are doing out of nothing. How risky and courageous." So out of this nothingness, Brigida House today, we have 9 people working there. They're all professional therapists or master's students serving on the staff. We've had interns from Antioch and Evergreen and Leos. We have use of this wonderful Victorian house. We have about 30 to 40 children that we see a week. We have hourly appointments. The children are choosing to be there. Oftentimes the children come with the parents initiating, or a teacher may initiate that they come to Brigida House. But once they're there and they develop a relationship with one of the staff, we make it real clear to them that it is their choice. We somehow pay the bills, not all the time, but most of the time. We do not charge fees, and the children have the choice. What I'm going to do now is stop and take a break. And when we come back, I'll talk more about what Brigida House has become today. But while during the break, we have a couple people here from the staff, Dot Kelly and Marilyn Sturbeck, and my husband Jim and myself. Dot and Marilyn, you want to raise your hands there? One is what field my father was in as a professor, and it was anthropology, not mathematics as was suggested. The other question is, how did we survive? We really did take a whole year off with neither of us working at all, and part of that was on the sale of a home that we had sold in California. It also meant going to zero and taking that risk. But after a year or so, Jim started a consulting business, and he's a professional facilitator, does creative problem solving, does workshops both in Port Townsend and in different businesses throughout the United States. So it was a long time coming to get his business to a point where it could really support us, but it's because of his business that I have been able to make this choice to work in this way, which I am very grateful about. I'm going to start with a dream. This is a dream of a client. I go to see Jean, but her office, her home is at Fort Worden, and it's very small. And she and her family are living like paupers, and I am surprised. I turn to her and ask if she has given up so much for Brigida House, and she responds, "Yes." Actually, that's in part response to the question of how did we survive. It has been a financial sacrifice, and I think if it weren't for the dreams, that I don't think that I could stay with it. I'd have to say that the dreams were the number one part. And that the following of the dreams came over a long period of time. As I told you, my first dream that I recorded and paid attention to, I was 32, and I'm now 47. So it was several years of learning in what ways I can pay attention to dreams and how that works for me. And I would also say that what kept things going were the moments of being with the children. And there are those just wonderful, pure moments of joy and magic where both of you are entering and witnessing the mystery together, and you realize that this is what's so important, to be able to protect that and to let that stay alive. And then there certainly were people in my life, my husband and my son and Russell Lockhart and others, that also helped me to stay with what Brigida House was coming to be. And in the past 5 years of Brigida House, I'd say the first 4 years at least, were really spent on a lot of physical structuring. We had this old Victorian house. We needed to tear down walls. We needed to paint. I should say, mostly, when I say we, it was me and oftentimes one other person. But mostly it was myself. At Brigida House, though we don't charge any fees, we ask the parents that if they are interested in contributing financially to Brigida House, we certainly accept donations. But I ask them to think in doing it in terms of giving to Brigida House as a whole, and then not to think about the exact number of times their child has come to Brigida House. And we have received money in this way. And there are other ways that parents give in terms of just volunteering their services. We've had parents dig up the backyard and replant the grass and paint the porch and do lots of different things around to keep the house going. And it's also the first few years were also a structuring time of developing it as a business, because after all, Brigida House is in some ways a business. And so it's been getting conditional use permits to use the house the way we want to use it, applying to the forms for IRS, soliciting funds, giving talks to local organizations. All these things have been very, very difficult for me as an extreme introvert. It's been a constant push for me to have to deal with these things. But now that work is mostly completed, and we are now using the whole entire house. There were times when we actually rented out part of the house. There were times when I got real desperate, and about 2 years ago when we first got the house, and I just got this idea. A lot of people like to come to Port Townsend, particularly from Seattle, and there's often, you know, no room at the inn over there. And so I had the idea of opening Brigida House up on Friday and Saturday nights by word of mouth. And people started coming. In fact, I think, was it you, Randy? Were you the first one to spend the night there and donate to Brigida House? And people would ask me what we charge, and I'd say, well, this is real, you know, $20, $30 will be fine. One night, I didn't say any amount. I just gave them my usual tour of Brigida House and told them that whatever they contribute. Because when they came, when people came to Brigida House, they were desperate. There was no place. There were no motels or hotels. They were thrilled that they could come to anything. And then when they got there, discovered they had an entire Victorian house, they were just thrilled. And there's no one there living at night, and the children aren't there at night. So they actually had a kitchen and a couple bathrooms and whatever. But, you know, this is not a great, glorious Victorian house. This is a house that's needed a lot of work. So anyway, this one particular night, I decided not to mention any money and just told them, you know, whatever they wanted to leave. And they left a check for $70. Mm. So from then on, I just said, just leave a donation. So we've gotten a lot of money in ways like that. Of course, it was illegal what I was doing. If the city had found out, I would probably gotten into some kind of trouble. Also, when we first, Barbara Bowen purchased the house for us, she forgave the rent for 6 months, which was an incredible gift to us, because I don't know how we would have made it those first few months. Another person in town anonymously paid for the printing of the What newspaper for about 8 months. And that was another gift that we couldn't have gone. And I still don't know who that person is. I thank you, whoever you are. So there have been these little kinds of ways. There's been a trying to get money, which has been go out and fill out a grant and send it away, fill out the forms and send it away. And most of those have come back zero. What has happened is when somebody has come to Brigida House and has had the experience of seeing and being at Brigida House, then something has come out of that. An example of that is when we needed insurance. I went to our local insurance broker and told him I needed insurance. He said, well, are you a school? No. Are you a counseling center? Well, not really. And, well, he didn't know how he was going to insure us. So in the meantime, Cairo TV had heard about the children doing the What newspaper, and they had called me and asked me if they could come over and do a little 10-minute thing on Brigida House and the What newspaper. And it was shown on Saturday morning, some children's show, I forget the name of it. And some insurance guy in Seattle just happened to have his TV on and see it and called our broker and said, is this what you're talking about that you want insurance for? And he said, yes. He said, well, I'll insure that. And that's been how it has worked. It's frustrating at times because you'd like to be able to have a 10-year plan. Back to my strategy planning days. And you'd like to feel that what we're doing has a tremendous amount of value. I think each of us on the staff have had a real struggle with dealing with that. I mean, if what we're doing is so valuable, then why doesn't our culture value it? And there's a difficulty in communicating what we're doing to the parents and to others in the community without jeopardizing the relationship with the child. One of the key successes, I think, to Brigida House has been the fact that we aren't really upfront about the fact that we're doing therapy with the children. I mean, it's not like we're hiding it, but there isn't a label on the front of the house that says therapy center. So when children come, they're coming to Brigida House. And they know about the What newspaper. That's been wonderful because we sell it in the schools. And, oh, this is the place where the What newspaper is published, and maybe I can get something published in the paper. And that's been really helpful to help have a child be able to make the choice to have the experience. And there's also been the pain of being misunderstood and not really to understand what's happening there. And then, of course, there's the financial sacrifice. And everybody that has now, as I said, we now have a staff of 9, and we've been sort of steady at number 9. I keep promising the staff I won't say yes to anybody else that calls. We actually have a waiting list for people wanting to work on the staff. Not only do we have a waiting list for children, but we have a waiting list for staff. And this morning we got another call from a woman who wants to work at Brigida House through her practicum, I guess, you know. And I've been given the clear message from the staff that I'm just saying no. We're really full. We can't handle any more people than we have in the facility that we have and maintain the integrity of working with the children individually. And money can contaminate what is happening. It's important to know the source of where the money is coming from. And if it hasn't been, there's a feeling of it being disconnected to Brigida House, it hasn't worked. For a while, when we were struggling, I discovered that one of the children I was working with was, I could get crime victims compensation. So I filled out the forms and I sent them into the state, and I had to find out what DMS3 codes were and how this was all going to work. And I went through that whole process. And I innocently sent in my first report about how I was working with this child. And the child had been sexually abused when she was 3. And when I was seeing her, she was now 4. And since the sexual abuse, she'd been in about 3 different foster homes. She had witnessed her mother trying to commit suicide. She had been kidnapped and taken out of state and brought back by a stranger. All these things I brought up in my report, and I got a letter back from the state saying, we are paying you only to deal with that sexual abuse that happened with the child, the crime victim. And none of this other stuff we want to know anything about. And it was very difficult for me, and eventually I finally had to say no to getting money in that way. I also worry about what it means for the child to have these reports. Where are these reports going? Where are they being filed? What do they mean for the child? So it all has come, it keeps coming back every time we try to make an attempt to charge fees or to figure out how to make that work financially for exactly for that particular child. It continues to not work. And then there's the label of saying at risk. If we were to say that we work with at-risk children, which many of the children, if you were to consider a definition of that label, you'd say most of the children we work with at Brigida House would be considered at risk in some way. Of course, I feel that all children are at risk, and all adults are at risk. So if we were to go to the state and say we work with these children and these children are at risk, there probably would be a possibility of getting funding. But what would that mean for Brigida House? We would suddenly get this reputation for being working with children at risk. So does the 12-year-old who feels like they'd like to have this experience and feels rather healthy going to come to Brigida House if there's that label there? Probably not. So again, to protect the choice of the child to enter into therapeutics on their own choice, we have taken away that label. And there's been also different, you know, there's been different ways of getting money in terms of the parents, too, and other sources. There's one parent that I've been working with her children for a couple of years. And by the way, at least three of us on the staff also work with adults through Brigida House. And we have our adult practice through Brigida House. And the money that is given for the adult practice we give is a donation to Brigida House. It contributes to the ongoingness of Brigida House. So, and we also work with parents without charging money in terms of just the relationship that we have with the child. So we there's one parent that we work with. Been working with two of her children for over a year, and I hadn't ever asked her. She'd never given anything to Brigida's, and I hadn't asked anything of her. And one day I asked her if she'd be willing to make some chocolate chip cookies for our board meeting because she's sort of a professional cookie maker in town. And she called back and said, yes, she'd be very willing to do that if I would give her a check to pay for the ingredients. And I knew, you know, I knew that was okay, that that's where she needed to be at that time, and that was okay. And it's having to sort of let go and not look at the children as if this, to not feel resentful, you know, to the parent for this choice, or to have that resentment come out towards the children. But there was another situation where we needed to have some painting done on the porch, and I went to the local Kiwanis Club and asked them if anybody would be willing to help me paint the porch. And one day I got a phone call from an elder in our community, a dentist, and he asked if he could come help, and he showed up in his paint clothes. And so the two of us were painting, and I showed them around Brigida House while he was there, and he left, and I'd taken a picture of him painting the porch, and so I sent him a copy of the picture when it came back and just wrote him a little thank you note, you know, thank you for helping out and painting the porch. And he immediately sent us a check, a donation to Brigida House. And it's that sort of kind of unsolicited kinds of ways that I think have mostly been what has kept Brigida House alive. So what happens when the children are given this choice? Well, for one thing, they can come for longer periods of time. I think I haven't, you know, this isn't a matter of doing research. I don't know really what we'd compare it to. But the reality is that many of the children we work with, I'm sure, are in this therapeutic situation for much longer than they would be in normal circumstances where the parent, let's go back to the story of the parent calling saying, my child still wants to come and have this experience, but I'm not willing to pay is part of the reason that I moved away from charging fees. So it opens up this whole possibility of working with children for longer periods of time until they feel a sense of needing to go. And it's also, we can see children no matter what their situation is. If they're in foster care and then they go back to their family or go into another foster care, they can still always come to Brigida House because we're not dependent on certain funding. And there's also the sense of the child freely choosing this work, which I think just in itself is a strengthening for the child's image of the self, is being able to make that choice, you know, for themselves. And the issue of charging fees, you know, has been a difficult thing to, because as you can tell, it's very much a part of my psyche and my vision and what's happened for me. But then when others join the staff, it's not necessarily a part of their vision. And so it's been, it's like I was telling before, we've been working with the external aspects of the walls of Brigida House. I think right now the walls look pretty good, and we're dealing now more with the internal aspect of Brigida House and how do we work together. And if we're all working with a sense of sharing the dreams and the visions of what the psyche presents, how do we do that now as a team? How do we do that as a group of individuals when it's not just my responding to the psyche, but there's nine of us? And it's been a real challenge, a real growing challenge for all of us on the staff. There's, you know, when we bring up the issue of charging fees, oftentimes we think, well, gee, if we just started charging fees, we could start making some money here. And there's that coming back to, you know, where that's all coming from. And then there's the child, you know, experience. And I think that what the child is actually experiencing, I've shown a lot in terms of the dreams, the little hints that came in all my previous dreams, the hints that I didn't get as they came along. You know, we started out with that whole quality of blackness and what's that all about. And there's this duality of the unicorn. And there's something about friendship and love. And there's something about letting go of being a therapist that allows you then to be a therapist. And there's something about doing together. and doing out of nothingness, and that they experience a safe place where they are respected and trusted for unveiling their inner selves, whether they're shooting baskets or telling a story that is heard and maybe even perhaps printed, or letting themselves speak through the miniatures in the sand tray room. Many children that I've worked with, and I think other staff members have experienced this too, is that the child recognizes that this isn't just a normal situation. I mean, they know this, hey, this isn't school, and this isn't dance class or whatever. And they often are needing to give it a name themselves. And there's two stories I'd like to share here that really touched me. One was a little boy in the middle of doing a sand tray just turned and looked at me, and he said, "I know what you are." And I said, "What?" And he says, "You're the weather lady." And another little girl was doing a sand tray. Actually, I think she was painting a picture. And her mother had called it going to art class because her mother needed to give it a name as well. And so she told the daughter she was going to art class. So I said, "Okay, that's fine." So one day the little girl looked at me and she says, "This is an art class." And I said, "No, why not?" She says, "Well, if this was art class, you'd be a teacher, and you're not a teacher. And I'd be taking my paintings home, and I don't take my paintings home. So this is not art class." So I was real quiet for a while, and all of a sudden she said, "I know what it is." And I said, "What?" She says, "This is my not art, not class time." She was about six. Yeah. Well, I'm going to close and give some time for some questions here, and I'm going to end with a little bitty dream that I had, probably the shortest dream that I've had. It was a dream where I experienced everything being connected. That's what you mean, right? She said if I brought my hands together, we'd have sound effects. I had the experience of everything being connected, but the experience was so powerful that it could only last for about 4 seconds. But there was a sense of experiencing it. And I feel that the story of Brigida House is the story of the delicate, intricate weaving of the inner and the outer as they come together. And it's also the story of a manifestation of the psyche in community. It has come back through into community, and that it's available to each of us. And I hope that in sharing tonight that we can all sort of share that potential that's in each of us in that way. So do you have any questions? Yes.
How would this respond now? I'm thinking of how this, you know, how this affects the family life, how he relates to mom, if he doesn't see you as anything but mom, spending all this time with you doesn't fit.
Well, that is, I think that's something that all of us on the staff with children have struggled with. He's 17. But when Brigida House really got going, he was probably about in sixth grade, and he was part of the group that got the What newspaper going and was very much a part of it. But part of needing to move Brigida House out of my home into the neighboring home was to protect him as well as my husband, too, because it was interfering too much with, you know, these children are all coming to the house, and there needed to be that separation. But it is an issue, I think, that those of us who have children, younger children, that it's hard. Yes. Well, I don't either. The unicorn is an image, I think, in Jungian terms, we often see it as an image of the self, capital S, and I really would rather not try to share any more information because I don't feel very knowledgeable about it. In going through my notes and my journals, I realized that I've done a lot of writing about it, and I didn't really go over those notes in preparation of coming here. But that essence of there being two sides, we talk about the yin and the yang and the dark and the light and whatever, that there's something in the essence of the unicorn that it carries all of that. And in this work that I did with this little boy, we now have a lot of unicorns in our sanctuary room, but in the work I did with this little boy, that part of showing the splitting and the finally bringing the two unicorns together, the way that he did it in his sanctuary was very revealing about what that's all about. But I don't feel prepared tonight to go into it more than that. Someday I'm going to write about it. Mandy.
Can you say some more about how you think the community supports housing, like the schools or the neighborhood or the city as a whole, the city council, and the other students support the community? Would you have asked, would you be like a question about the community question or the community?
No.
So how do you?
Well, as I said, it was Brigida House first began. We did work with groups of children, and they were actively doing the What newspaper, which meant going downtown, which is a small town, and knocking on doors and getting advertising. The children would then design the ads and whatever. So the merchants became very aware of the What newspaper. Then the children as a group would do certain activities and participate in different things in the community. Like we have a local parade every spring, and the What kids involved with the What newspaper and Brigida House would all gather together. So they had this image of Brigida House being this wonderful place that helps children after school, and they have this place that they can go and they can do things, and isn't this all just wonderful? Unfortunately, I encouraged that. I think out of the fear of not being able to articulate what was really being experienced. It certainly was not a lie. That certainly was very much a part of Brigida House. But I think that I felt as long as the community could see it that way, what harm could be done. We became a part of United Good Neighbors, and United Good Neighbors was very interested in that part of Brigida House. And what's happening for me now is needing to really go back and to really see what's really happening and to risk articulating and saying to the world and the community, and this has been a major step for me in being here tonight and being able to speak this way about what really is happening at Brigida House. And the staff right now, we're all working together, and we're creating a proposal that is, we've given the fictitious name of Marge. Marge is a person who has lots of money and is somebody who can hear what Brigida House is about. And so we're writing a proposal. We're going to send her a financial statement. We're going to send her what our dreams and our wishes are in terms of money. And we're going to write and share some stories with her and tell her exactly what's happening at Brigida House. When we get this all together, then we're going to see who Marge may be. Hopefully we'll all have a dream. But I think that process right now is a turning point for Brigida House and is an important one to really let the world know what it is. It's a very difficult issue. It's a difficult issue with the parents when they come, to how to really communicate to the parents. We encourage parents not to come in the house. Once they've seen Brigida House, we ask them to stay outside and not come in. And encourage the children to come in and out on their own so we can have this sort of help sort of contain the space. And when the children do art, they do a painting or do clay work, it stays at Brigida House. We don't have them take it home. They have a box for it there. And that's come out of my experience of seeing that something different happens for the child in doing art. If they know it's going home and going on the refrigerator door or whatever, something different happens. Then if it's not going, they're not taking it home to mother or dad, then it's just for themselves. Well, we don't really have any rules at Brigida House. No, I might say that's one of our rules. They all get broken. When I talk to the staff about that, I tell them if you have a sense of really knowing that this is important for the child, if it's a particular situation where they need to take it home, then that's, you know, fine. And I think we just have to sort of trust. I had one child where they were wanting to take their paintings home. And so one day she took the painting. We have a window in the front of the house, and she turned the painting and asked me for some scotch tape, and she put it up so that the painting showed outside. And then she said, now when my mother comes, she can see it. And so that showed me two things. One is that there was a real sensitivity for her there in terms of sharing her art with her mother. But it also helped me to see that there was even a greater need to contain what she was doing. So from then on, I did most of my artwork with her back in the art room so that it wasn't quite so visible to the world. And it was only then that her art began to change. So we always bend. Also, we tend to start collecting things after a while. So after a while, there's a need to have the children take some things home, particularly the clay pieces. And of course, we have lots of slides. And as I said in the beginning, this is a difficult issue, you know. Where is the... It's something I'm really dealing with right now, the whole moral issue about sharing the children's work in this way. So someday maybe share the slides. Yes. Mostly the sand trays. and occasionally other paintings or drawings or whatever. I would say most of the children that I've worked with, if sometimes they aren't aware. I take the tray. The sand tray, when a child does a sand tray, it stays and then they leave and then we put the things away. And so the pictures can be taken after they've actually left the room. But my experience has been if a child knows that I'm taking a picture, that it makes them feel real, that it's that their art is whatever it is they created has a real sense of specialness about it. In fact, in the early days, when I first started working with children, I used a video camera, and I videoed all my sessions, and until I realized that you quickly end up having lots of tapes and no time to edit, so I stopped that. I stopped doing that. But the children were fascinated with that they were going to be on film. And sometimes they'd turn the camera on me and say, now it's your turn.
I'm just interested to know about how the time is structured there. It seems to have a lot of choice, but like, do they have choice to come there every day?
They have an hourly appointment, 45-minute appointment. So they come at a set time, and they always are working with the same staff member each time. And once they are there, there is sometimes, because we have so many children and so many staff now, we're a little bit limited on, like, for instance, only one sand tray room. So if a little black cat is outside the sand tray room, then it's not available to another child. These are some issues we're having to sort of deal with right now. And we're thinking of setting up another sand tray room in the art room so there can be more than one space. But so we've had to be a little bit flexible in giving the children choice. But they do have a set time. Yeah. And if the child wants to come more than once a week and the staff wants to do that, then we do that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, local in Jefferson County, it's not just Port Townsend. We have children that come from Chimacum and Port Hadlock. In fact, we've been thinking about developing a Brigida bus. Or a Brigida boat, and going to some of the neighboring communities. There certainly is a growing need in that way. Well, we'll end it, and thank you very much.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.